This is the podcast, Constitution for Democracy, from the Albert Fishman Center on Democracy and the Cost Action, Constitution Making, and Deliberative Democracy. I am Chanina Well, and together with experts on the topic, I will explore the main challenges deliberative constitution making is facing nowadays. Commonly, constitutions in force either do not regulate their replacement or put in place obstacles that make change very difficult. These difficulties in times of crisis of legitimacy provide incentives to the clash between the so-called popular will and the status quo. This represents a real contemporary challenge. In this first episode, we want to explore why is it so difficult to change constitutions in democracies. In this episode, we want to consider constitution making in democratic scenarios. The writing of new constitutions is frequently observed in exceptional, disruptive contexts such as the colonization process, military coups, or transitions. In contrast, the elaboration of new constitutions in stable and consolidated democracies is uncommon. To talk about the topic, we have today one of the top world experts on comparative constitutional politics.
Hi, Janina. I'm Gabriel Negreto, professor of political science at the Catholic University of Chile, and I work on comparative constitutional politics, electoral reform, and constitutional reform in comparative perspective.
In your edited book, Redrafting Constitutions in Democratic Regimes, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020, you identified only 25 cases between 1900 and 2015. How do you explain this low frequency?
Well, you see, the number of democracies that have replaced their constitutions is not very high compared to the number of constitutions that have been enacted in the world, either in a transition to democracy or within an authoritarian regime. But that is easily explained for several reasons. On the one hand, because, you know, democracies have constitutions that were enacted at the beginning of the democratic period, or they were adapted to democratic conditions. So these constitutions usually enjoy some sort of legitimacy that keeps them, you know, in force for a relative long time. But the other factor is that democratic constitutions usually do foresee a procedure for their replacement. That makes it particularly hard to replace them completely, that is, to create a new constitution within a democratic regime. And that makes the amendment or the partial reform a preferable option in general. That's why we see across the world relatively few constitutions that are replaced, that are enacted within an existing democratic regime. That's mainly the reason.
Let me move now to a topic especially sensitive in the contemporary debate, but with historical roots, the citizens' engagement. During the preparation of the French Constitution of 1793, Jean-Jacques Rousseau not only thought that constitution-making power had to be exercised on periodic and direct procedures, but also proposed to have it legally regulated by law. On the opposite, Emmanuel Joseph Sieyès ruled out such possibility of a regular and direct exercise and rejected any attempt to facilitate direct and frequent citizens' participation. Ratified in a referendum, this French constitution regulated the direct ratification of laws by primary assemblies, but it never entered into force after being suspended by a state of emergency. Constitutions, then, tend to be rigid, as we mentioned earlier, but there is a growing claim to change it to somehow confront these two traditional approaches to citizens' participation in constitution making. What do you think about that? What do you think would be the role citizens' participation should have during the constitution making process? And what about after, once the constitution is approved and enters into force?
Well, you know, citizen participation is, of course, an important part of any process. But that makes it particularly hard to pin down the substantive meaning of participation in constitution making. Even constitutions made within an authoritarian regime or in an authoritarian year are being made with some sort of participation. Of course, there is a presumption that citizen participation, once we have free and fair elections, it's more meaningful. Having said that, there is a world of variations within democratic participation in constitution making. Sometimes participation is purely, you know, window dressing, not exactly the same as in an authoritarian moment, but not so different in consequences. Those who do research on these areas have tried to establish, you know, some notions, some perspectives to understand, you know, when participation, when citizen participation is more consequential. So one factor that is important is timing. Certainly participation cannot be that meaningful when participation occurs within a very short span of time. Just to put, you know, an example, in Hungary, during the making of the 2011 constitution under the leadership of Fidesz, there was supposedly an instance of participation where citizens were able to send comments to the draft, but that lasted a few days. No one could track the use of the comments. There was no feedback, and those kind of, you know, forms of participation can be considered, you know, fake exercises. On the other hand, we have forms of participation that take a long time, have different instances. For instance, participating at the time of defining the menu of options for reform, that is, that tends to occur either before the constitution making process is activated, or right at the beginning, at the time of producing the first draft. That's a very important type of participation, because if enough time is given to, you know, discuss, debate the first draft, and then those comments are taken into account and there is some sort of feedback or devolution of those comments before the final approval, that kind of creates a commitment on the part of constitution makers. And that's the most rare type of participation that we see. It's the less frequent. For instance, now in Chile, there is an undergoing constitution making process that is highly participatory, but certainly there are and there will be important time constraints. So basically, citizens were allowed to participate and they will participate at the end, ratifying the constitution. But given the time constraint, the constitution has to be made in a year at the most, and there will be no time really, unless there is one more extension, which I doubt, to discuss, to receive comments, to generate some public debate about the draft itself. So time constraints are always work somehow against meaningful participation. And, you know, the objective of democratic constitution makings is to reach a balance between, you know, the demands of participation and other needs, like, you know, reducing uncertainty. Because, you know, extending a constitution making process also implies increasing or maintaining a relatively high level of uncertainty, you know, legal, political, economical, you know, for a relatively long time.
Gabriel, in your edited book, you stress that democratic constitutional replacements may enhance and deepen democratization or give way to gradual but sure process of democratic backsliding. What matters to explain one or other result? Could you illustrate it with examples?
In order to assess the possible consequences in terms of democratization, there are two factors to take into account. One of them is the process itself, that is, what happened at the time of the process, at the time of the drafting of the new constitution. And then, of course, you know, what happens after the constitution is enacted, which is equally crucial. What we know in comparative political science and in comparative constitutional law is that what matters in the process is, to begin with, the existence of political pluralism. You know, the most successful cases of constitutional replacement and successful in terms of deepening democratization after the enactment of the new constitution, have our constitutions made, you know, through the agreement, representatives of organized political interests. And organized political interests that have the capacity to articulate the interests of distinctive social groups. The second component is its participation, but participation plays, at least for what we know in empirical studies and in theoretical studies, participation matters once this first condition is met. That is, participation, another factor that empirically is very, very strong, is the fact it's whether participation follows a politically plural agreement, you know, in terms of the activation of the process, the design of the constitution, or it goes along with, you know, a more centralized, more unilateral type of constitution making process. Participation tends to be fake, you know, once we have a non-plural process. It could mean also that a democratic party, but a party that turns hegemonic or dominates the process single-handedly, you know, designs the constitution, activates the process, and enacts the constitution. And in those cases, citizen participation tends to have a less significant impact in terms of democratization after enactment than in cases where participation occurs after a politically plural and inclusive type of process. In terms of what happens after the enactment, this is equally crucial. Of course, it's unrelated, not unrelated, but it's external to the process itself. The two factors that matter and that we know empirically that matter in terms of maintaining the positive democratizing effects of constitutional replacements are, on the one hand, the fact that there is a relatively stable equilibrium in the distribution of political power so that political opposition is significant. That is, that incumbent governments have no unilateral capacity to interpret and implement the constitution at their will. The other important factor is the strength of civil society. That is key. If civil society organizations remain strong or become stronger at the time that the constitution is enacted, the positive effects of constitution making are likely to keep producing effects over time. At the origins, the deepening of democracy requires the maintenance of political pluralism in terms of distribution of power between the incumbent government and the political opposition, and the maintenance of a vibrant and strong civil society.
Peter Bertie's gold-plated pension, $60,388,000 per annum. Ivan Yates, $4,000. Jesus, I should have brought me glasses.
Can't afford them.
The sounds we are listening are from a series of demonstrations that spread in Ireland between 2008 and 2009 after an economic downturn, banking scandals, explosion of property bubble, and many unpopular decisions affecting people's lives. This protest created the ground for one of the most innovative experiences with so-called democratic innovations in recent times. To know more about it, we have with us a scholar who has carefully studied and also been engaged in the process.
Hi, I'm Jane Souter, Professor of Political Communication in Dublin, and I've been involved with the Irish Citizens' Assemblies.
Iceland and Ireland shared some commonalities. In both countries, an economical crisis launched social protest and a claim for institutional change. And in both, one of the most relevant innovations of our times were included, the sorted citizens' assemblies. Jane, how do you explain the relative success in Ireland and the failure in Iceland, where till now the constitutional reform or replacement is a pending issue?
Yeah, I think both the Icelandic and the Irish one started about the same time. And in fact, the Icelandic one was a little bit before the Irish one. And some of my colleagues would even have traveled there to look and see what they were doing. But they both came out of the really severe economic crisis in 2008 and a real sense that something new needed to be done about the political system. But I think what happened in Iceland is they dove right in and then they went for elections. So the people weren't randomly selected, and some of them had been politically activists, others were university professors, all sorts of different people. So I think then they did amazing work. They did, you know, they really produced an excellent document. But I think there wasn't a buy-in from all the political parties from it. So when a new government came in, they just ditched the whole thing and nothing went through. So I think it was that it was almost seen as a partisan exercise by some of the politicians in Iceland. In contrast, in Ireland, we actually started with a very kind of nerdy academic experiment to show that it could work, called We the Citizens, which was funded by philanthropy. And there we brought together a group of 100 randomly selected citizens, which I think is important actually, rather than elected, and showed that they could kind of make the trade-offs and they could deliberate and they could do all the kinds of things that politicians and others had always said that randomly selected citizens weren't capable of. And then this allowed the government to kind of look at it, and it allowed the different parties to look at it. And so all of the parties put this into their manifesto in 2011. So it didn't become something that divided the different parties when it was eventually put into place.
Several citizens' assemblies have been organized in Ireland with and without representatives of political parties. Are you in favor or against partisan participation in citizens' assemblies? And why?
So there's been different ways of looking at it. And I know, for example, that, say, Jim Fishkin in Stanford would have done work in China, and he'd have been very skeptical about political parties being involved. But one of the examples we'd looked at was the British Columbia Citizens' Assemblies, you know, a kind of a decade earlier, and Ontario, where they'd looked at electoral reform. And what had happened there was the citizens had voted for change to the electoral system. But again, some of the politicians had gone against it, and they campaigned against it and imposed a supermajority and so on. So while we were concerned in the beginning when the government said that they were going to put in citizens, actually Ken Carty from the University of British Columbia said, well, look, maybe this is actually a good thing because it'll actually allow the politicians to see from the inside how this works. It'll build up trust from the politicians in the process. I think Ken was proved absolutely right. So now afterwards, the politicians haven't been involved. So I think it was important in Ireland, at least, for the initial kind of trust building and for politicians to really see that citizens do take this seriously. They do take their job seriously. They are really considering trade-offs. You know, some of them said to me afterwards, it was the first time they'd ever engaged with citizens about policy issues that weren't things like, you know, needing a new sports hall or the road fixed or, you know, these kind of more transactional things that politicians often deal with citizens on. So I think it was eye-opening for a lot of the politicians. And then it meant that when the recommendations came through, they felt some loyalty to the process and they trusted it and therefore helped push it through rather than act against it, which is something we've seen in so many other countries.
What do you think about the role citizens' participation should have during the constitution-making process and after? Should it be a requirement everywhere?
Yeah, well, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and every country's constitution is different. But in Ireland, if you want to change the constitution, you must have a referendum involving all citizens. And in a former life, I studied referendums, and we often found that they were, you know, what's called second order elections. So people were voting on other things, whether or not they liked the government that was in power or, you know, all sorts of different things rather than the referendum issue. So I think that what we found with evidence is if we have the citizen assembly before a referendum, then it actually allows a greater amount of information, balanced information. It brings a different level of debate and it changes the partisan dynamics of the referendum. So I definitely think in the Irish circumstance, having a citizen assembly before a referendum would be really useful. And I know colleagues in Britain ran experimental citizens' assemblies after the Brexit vote. And again, they found that, you know, if there had been a citizen assembly before Brexit, it might well have changed the dynamics of that campaign. It might have improved the information environment in that campaign. So, you know, I think there's definitely a use, and it's definitely something to be considered, because there is the changing of the constitution just involves so many different dynamics, and the citizen assembly allows the citizens' interest to be entered, and it improves the information environment. And I think those two things are pretty useful in constitutional change and in referendums.
We are arriving to the end of this third episode of Constitutions for Democracy. Today, we ask, why is it so difficult to change constitutions in democratic settings? Gabriel Negreto, who is an expert on the topic, pointed out that this is not so strange, because constitutions were enacted at the beginning of the democratic period or adapted to it, and did not include procedures for their total replacement in general, with few exceptions. The most preferable or typical option is to amend constitutions. In terms of what matters to produce a democratizing effect after approving a new constitution, he stressed that it's very relevant to have political pluralism, the agreements on how to proceed, or the providing a legal framework for the replacement, equilibrium in the distribution of power at the time of writing the constitution, and after all that, a vibrant civil society. Shane Sweeter, who is an expert on democratic innovations, told us about the Icelandic experiment trying to produce a revolutionary total replacement, which did not succeed in producing a new constitution, and the Irish example, where the goals were a bit more modest, if you want, but did succeed in producing several amendments to the constitutions, engaging citizens' participation through an innovative procedure of sorted citizens' assemblies, in some occasions combined with referendums. Shane Sweeter also stressed that in some occasions could be relevant to include partisan actors, because it could produce a better connection with the political system. With all these, which were topics which will follow in future episodes, we finalize this episode of Constitutions for Democracy. Join us in a brand new conversation every month, or any podcatcher of your choice, by searching Constitutions for Democracy. And subscribe so you can get the latest updates on our episodes and our research.